Welcome to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis, a friend of Donald Trump, says the president was more angry last weekend than he had seen him in a long time. Christopher Ruddy, the CEO of right-wing magazine and website Newsmax and a member of Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club, wrote that he spoke to Trump twice on Saturday. The conversations followed Trump's explosive and unsubstantiated Saturday claim that President Barack Obama had Trump Tower's wires tapped before the 2016 presidential election.
Trump has not given any evidence to back up his claim, while a spokesman for Obama has denied that he ordered wiretapping of Trump. Still, Trump believes his accusations will eventually be proven, Ruddy notes in a Newsmax post. I spoke with the president twice yesterday about the wiretap story. I haven't seen him this ticked off in a long time. When I mentioned Obama denials about the wiretaps, he shot back, "This will be investigated. It will all come out. I will be proven right," he said. And Ruddy wrote this. Ruddy told CNN that Trump did not go into detail about his sources for the claim. The network previously reported that Trump got the accusations from right-wing media reports, not government sources. Trump's accusations followed the latest backlash about his top advisor's contacts with Russia.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions, a former senator who advised the Trump campaign, said last week he would recuse himself from all Trump campaign-related investigations after he appeared to mislead senators during his January confirmation hearing about his conversations with Russia's ambassador to the United States. The president argued that Sessions should not distance himself from any Russia-related probes. Ruddy, a Florida resident and longtime Mar-a-Lago member, also donated the maximum $2,700 to Trump's campaign committee and $100,000 to a joint fundraising effort with the Republican Party.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Friday asked the remaining 46 U.S. attorneys appointed by President Obama to resign. According to the Justice Department, those resignations will ensure a uniform transition.
Until the new U.S. attorneys are confirmed, the dedicated career prosecutions in our U.S. Attorney's Office will continue the great work of the department in investigating, prosecuting, and deterring the most violent offenders, said spokeswoman Sarah Isger Flores in a statement Friday afternoon. According to Flores, both the George W. Bush and Clinton administrations had a similar request at the beginning of their presidencies. President Obama phased out Bush administration attorneys more gradually.
The request came just days after Sessions sent a memo to all of the department's prosecutors asking them to make fighting violent crime a top priority. In March of 1993, when Sessions was a U.S. attorney in Alabama, Clinton's Attorney General Janet Reno asked him to resign.
President Trump's coattails will be put to the test in a string of special elections this year, where Republicans clamor for his support and Democrats seek to turn anti-Trump energy into upsets on red territory.
Several Trump acolytes are on the ballot, most notably in Virginia, where a former campaign chairman is running for governor, and in Georgia, where Bruce Lavelle, who spearheaded minority outreach for the Trump campaign, is part of a crowded field of candidates looking to fill the congressional seat left empty by Mr. Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary. "I got in the race because I believe in the president's agenda," Mr. Lavelle said. "He's going to need a champion in the White House." That is a common theme among the 11 other Republicans in the primary for a usually reliably red district, but where Mr. Trump won by a thin 1 percentage point margin in November. Republican candidates in special elections in Kansas, Montana, and South Carolina, who also had lawmakers leave Congress to join the Trump administration, make similar boasts of allegiance to Mr. Trump.
The White House has remained mum about the role the president envisions playing in this year's election cycle, which also features governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. Mr. Trump's political team, however, has kept in regular contact with state Republican Party leaders and with some of the campaigns, officials said.
President Donald Trump is looking to speed up the deportation of illegal immigrants by relocating some judges to detention centers. In a letter from the Department of Justice, or DOJ, obtained by Reuters, the Trump administration is moving 50 judges to detention facilities in areas like Adelanto and San Diego, California, as well as Chicago, Illinois. Additionally, the DOJ will ask immigration judges to hear cases from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., with two rotating shifts to hear more cases. A source close to the DOJ told Reuters that judges will be able to volunteer for the some 50 deployments to detention centers, but if not enough signed on, judges would be assigned. Last month, Breitbart, Texas, reported on a Department of Homeland Security memo that requested the Trump administration allow federal immigration courts to use expedited deportation proceedings for any illegal immigrants living in the U.S. for 2 years or less. The process is currently limited to those only living in the U.S. for up to 2 weeks.
President Trump said Friday night he will nominate Scott Gottlieb, a former deputy commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, to lead the agency. Mr. Gottlieb, a physician, is a partner in the venture capital firm New Enterprise Associates and serves as an advisor on several pharmaceutical companies. If confirmed by the Senate, he would lead oversight of the federal agency that decides whether to approve new drugs, as well as regulates food safety and tobacco products. In 2005, he was appointed as the FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs in the George W. Bush administration.
Pollster Nate Silver, who was dead wrong the entire campaign of 2016, took the media to task on Friday in his website's ongoing autopsy of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The man who predicted the winner of all 50 states in the 2012 election says a liberal media bubble that mainly encompasses New York and Washington, D.C., prevented journalists from considering the possibility of an Election Day win for Republican Donald Trump.
There really was a liberal media bubble, is the ninth installment on how President Trump defied conventional wisdom to win the White House. Political experts aren't a very diverse group and tend to place a lot of faith in the opinions of other experts and other members of the political establishment, Mr. Silver wrote. Once a consensus view is established, it tends to reinforce itself until and unless there's very compelling evidence for the contrary position. Social media, especially Twitter, can amplify the groupthink further. It can be an echo chamber. Silver went on to note multiple other factors that led to media groupthink and outlets that weren't contemplating the possibility of a Trump victory.
Some include a lack of racial and gender diversity in newsrooms and a lack of political diversity. As of 2013, only 7% of them identified as Republicans. Only two of 59 major newspapers endorsed Mr. Trump prior to the election, Mr. Silver said, before offering his advice for journalists.
America's population growth has hit the lowest rate since the Great Depression, driven by millennials stalling having families due to the bad economy, growing death rates, and a decrease in immigration, according to the Census Bureau. Population growth is at an 80-year low at 0.6%.
That's the lowest since 1936, and it's on track to drop even further over the next 25 years. In an analysis of the troubling trend from the Brookings Institution, the economy and increasing death rates of baby boomers was cited as the prime reasons. It is likely that some of the reduced fertility in recent years is attributable to recession-related delays in family formation among young adult millennials. This trend could reverse in the near future as the economy continues to grow. But higher death rates are likely to continue due to the long-term aging of the population, a phenomenon contributing to projected declines in U.S. growth rates, which could drop precipitously by 2040, said the analysis from William Fry, a Brookings senior fellow. Fry noted that some of the earlier population declines were due to a drop in immigration, but it has recently stabilized at 1 million. as immigration levels have increased in the past 3 years, now hovering around 1 million annually. Low natural increase, the excess of births over deaths, has played a bigger role as the birth rate has declined and the death rate has risen, says the analysis. He also found that the Sun Belt is experiencing growth again and that the Snow Belt is getting hammered with losses.
And that may not be a bad thing since the economy is reviving in the South. Overall, the United States seems to be in the midst of a population growth paradox. As the nation's population growth continues to stagnate due to fertility declines in the context of an aging population, internal population shifts help places like the Sun Belt continue to grow. Because the latter is more economically driven than the former, it is encouraging to see that a key demographic indicator of a strong economy, migration in response to newly emerging employment opportunities, is reviving in tandem with the economy, wrote Frey. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after this.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joel Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The helping hand offered by social welfare programs is being utilized by most legal and illegal immigrant families. The latest signs that many immigrants come to America for the taxpayer-funded benefits like Medicaid, subsidized food and cash, according to a new report based on census data. In analyzing new census reports, the Center for Immigration Studies found that immigrant families with one or more children use welfare far more than Native American families.
Welfare used by illegal immigrant households is certainly a concern, but the bigger issue is welfare used by legal immigrants, said Stephen Camerata, the center's director of research and author of the report. Three-fourths of immigrant households using welfare are headed by legal immigrants. Legal immigration is supposed to benefit the country, yet so many legal immigrants are not able to support themselves or their children. This raises important questions about the selection criteria used for legal immigration, said Camerata. The report highlights the economics of immigration, especially illegal immigration, and comes as Syrian refugees are seeking to settle in European nations that provide rich welfare benefits.
The report also suggests that America is attracting poor and uneducated immigrants. Low levels of education, not legal status, are the main reason immigrant welfare use is high, said the center's preview of their report, released Thursday. According to the report provided in advance to Secrets, households headed by legal immigrants have statistically significant higher use of welfare than native households overall, and for cash and food programs, as well as Medicaid. This is the case a decade and a half after the 1996 welfare reform law, which was supposed to greatly limit immigrant access to the welfare system. It added, if one assumes that legal immigration is supposed to benefit the country, then immigrants allowed into the country should have much lower rates of welfare use than natives. However, our best estimate is that 49% of households headed by legal immigrants used at least one welfare program in 2012.
Other key findings pulled from the report, legal immigrant households account for three-quarters of all immigrant households accessing one or more welfare programs. Of legal immigrant households with children, 72% access one or more welfare programs compared to 52% of native households. Of households headed by immigrants in the country illegally, they estimate that 62% used one or more welfare programs in 2012 compared to 30% of native households. Households headed by immigrants illegally in the country have higher use rates than native households overall and for food programs, 57% versus 22%, and Medicaid, 51% versus 23%. Use of cash programs by illegal immigrants is lower than use by natives, 5% versus 10%, as is the use of housing programs, 4% versus 6%. Of illegal immigrant households with children, 87% access one or more welfare programs compared to 52% of native households.
Education level plays a larger role in explaining welfare use than legal status. The most extensive use of welfare is by less educated immigrants who are in the country legally. Of households headed by legal immigrants without a high school diploma, 75% use one or more welfare programs, as do 64% of households headed by legal immigrants with only a high school education. Restrictions on new legal immigrants' access to welfare have not prevented them from accessing programs at high rates because restrictions often apply to only a modest share of immigrants at any one time. Some programs are not restricted. There are numerous exceptions and exemptions, and some provisions are entirely unenforced. Equally important, immigrants, including those illegally in the country, can receive welfare on behalf of their U.S.-born children.
The number of adult baptisms in the Austrian Catholic Church has more than doubled over the last year. The church claims the rise is due to a huge influx of migrants from Afghanistan and Iran converting to Christianity. The Archdiocese of Vienna has announced that 254 men and women were selected for baptism after completing the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, or RCIA, taking part in a baptism ceremony conducted by Austrian Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, De Pries reports. The group of converts had to wait a year to be prepared for baptism, a recent move by the church due to the number of requests by Muslim asylum seekers for conversion.
The baptism ceremony was not opened to the public due to the fears of many of the converts that they would face retaliation from other Muslims or even attacks against their family, particularly those who come from Iran. Cardinal Schönborn declared the day a celebration for the church, saying it was a great and moving day for the Church of Vienna. That they want to follow Christ and live in his fellowship is also a call to us, which we have the happiness and the privilege of growing up in faith from childhood, but may have forgotten how precious this is, he added. Schönborn, who many see as a likely successor to Pope Francis, has made headlines several times in recent months. In September, he said that many Muslims actively sought to conquer Europe for Islam. 3 months later, he slammed European politicians and their migrant policies, saying that the migrant crisis had gone too far and that it was better to help migrants where they lived. He added that he was shocked by the sheer number of migrants who have come to Europe in recent years.
The conservative cardinal has also been at odds with many European leaders in regards to U.S. President Donald Trump. In early January, he compared Trump to former President Ronald Reagan, saying, "Many also shook their heads when Ronald Reagan was elected. For God's sake, an actor from California," Schönborn said. "But Reagan was certainly one of the best presidents the U.S. ever had," he said. "So you should not be too quick to judge." The trend of conversions is also seen in neighboring Germany, but some are skeptical of the motives of those converting. Two Syrian migrants living in Lebanon even admitted that they had converted because it gave them a better chance of claiming asylum in Europe.
A conservative legal defense organization is trying to take advantage of a door of opportunity to help persecuted Christians get religious asylum in the United States. The Pacific Justice Institute reports that a Christian missionary who was jailed and tortured by authorities in two Middle Eastern countries has recently been granted religious asylum by the U.S. With a new administration in the White House, PJI President Brad Dukakis explains there will be greater opportunity to help persecuted Christians find safe haven in America.
Especially over the last 8 years, Christians have had a back seat when it comes to coming to the United States seeking asylum and protection, Dukakis contended. Instead, other immigrants have received preferential treatment instead of those whose lives are literally on the line because of their faith. Dukakis told One News Now that the Obama administration put the country in a terrible position by bringing in more than 10,000 Syrian refugees without any proper vetting. To add insult to injury, he noted that just slightly more than 50 of the refugees were Christians. The Christians were being persecuted the greatest and were the most least protected and most ignored when it came to refugee status coming to the United States, the legal expert explained. Dacus maintains that while the Trump administration's new policies are completely reversing the old immigration policy, PJI will be doing its part to protect those seeking asylum who are in the U.S. We will defend Christians currently in America who wish to be granted asylum and do not want to be sent back by the present system, where they will be sent to almost a certain torment, torture, or even death, he said.
Judicial Watch has filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against several federal agencies regarding records related to President Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, who recently stepped down from his position amidst controversy. Judicial Watch, a public interest group that investigates and prosecutes government corruption, maintains that the lawsuit is against the Central Intelligence Agency, the United States Department of Justice, and the Department of the Treasury, a legal battle over the intelligence leaks that ultimately led to Flynn's resignation.
Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton is closely monitoring the proceedings to get to the bottom of the recent wiretapping allegations aimed at former President Barack Obama. We're trying to figure out what went on there. Was the surveillance proper? How was it leaked? And who was behind the leak? Fitton announced. Fitton asserts that this case is specifically related to Trump's tweets in which he accused the Obama administration of wiretapping Trump Tower during last year's presidential campaign. There are victims here, and I think President Trump can make a good argument that he is a victim, the conservative watchdog insisted. Certainly, his aides were victimized with illegal leaks of classified material. Fitton also contends that leaked material was obtained for improper purposes.
President Obama's administration has a record of abusing its powers as long as my arm. So illicit surveillance and illegal leaks would be par for the course under this guy, the leader of the watchdog group pointed out. In theory, Fitton is confident that the only individuals facing serious jail time are the leakers of the information, and he believes that they are likely to be former Obama administration officials.
There may be an environmental benefit to the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines. After getting the green light from the Trump administration, Energy Transfer Partners, or ETP, says oil could be flowing in its Dakota Access pipeline as early as March 6th. One News Now reports that ETP says in court documents that it has finished drilling under Lake Oahe in North Dakota and will soon be laying pipe under the Missouri River Reservoir. The final stretch of the 1,200-mile pipeline that would run from the Dakotas through Iowa into Illinois.
We know that protests will continue, but this was an enormous accomplishment, says Jessica Cena, an independent communications advisor based in Montana. The U.S. boasts the largest pipeline network in the world, but 50% of all pipelines were built in the 50s and 60s, and that's where we run into problems. Meanwhile, TransCanada plans to finish the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline, specifically the portion that would run from western Canada to Nebraska. That matched with the Dakota Access Pipeline will mean fewer trains carrying crude oil. That should certainly please some of those who are opposed to the industry as a whole, Cena submits.
Transporting crude oil by train is considered more dangerous than pipelines. Think Progress says as much in a 2015 report. However, Think Progress points out that pipelines spill bigger, and that may result in environmentalists continuing their efforts to block the pipelines. American Indian tribes plan to continue fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline in court.
A national defense analyst says a brutal battle is coming in the Syrian town of Raqqa and the latest offensive to push back the Islamic State. The Islamic Caliphate, announced in 2014 by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, is approaching the end of its short and terrible life, Matthew Continetti, writing at the Washington Free Beacon, says, of the ongoing campaign by Iraqis, Syrians, Kurds, supported by U.S. troops, to beat back ISIS fighters.
ISIS wants to create an Islamic Caliphate and considers Raqqa to be the capital of that effort. The Syrian civil war, which began with protests against President Bashar al-Assad, has cost an estimated 400,000 lives since 2011, CNN has reported. A fight to dislodge ISIS from Raqqa will be bloody and dangerous due to a dug-in enemy who will employ IEDs and kill the innocent, says Bob McGinnis, a retired U.S. Army colonel, now at the Family Research Council. I think they'll die doing exactly what they've done in the past, he says.
Military.com reported this week that the U.S. Marine Artillery Unit quietly set up an artillery base weeks ago with 155-millimeter howitzers. They are there to support the push into Raqqa, the story said, citing the deployment of U.S. Marines. An analysis of U.S. involvement in Syria at the Washington Examiner predicts the U.S. is planning for a post-ISIS peace deal in the war-ravaged country. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after these messages.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joel Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The Center for Immigration Studies said the significant drop in illegal alien border crossings last month undoubtedly can be attributed to the fear of real border enforcement by the Trump administration. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly announced on Wednesday that the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency statistics reveal a 40% drop in illegal alien apprehensions at the Mexican border from January to February. The downturn came during the first full month of Trump's presidency.
Mark Kerkorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, contends the drop is even bigger than it looks. In fact, usually the number goes up from January to February because illegal immigrants may go home for Christmas and New Year's, and then they start to visit their family or whatever, and then start coming back to the U.S. in February, he explains. Kerkorian argues, based on that historical trend, the number of apprehensions should have gone up 10 or 15%. So the fact that they went down 40% really means it's more like 50% lower than it should be, he tells One News Now. I mean, that's pretty dramatic, quite frankly, and that's undoubtedly because of fears that we will now start enforcing the law under the Trump administration. Kerkorian cautions that this kind of drop won't be permanent unless the fear of immigration laws being enforced is actually backed up and justified with actions.
Secretary Kelly, according to the Associated Press, credited the steep declines to the president's executive orders on immigration calling for the border wall, hiring thousands of immigration agents, and cracking down on immigrants living in the U.S. illegally. He also implied that higher fees to smuggle aliens from Central America across the U.S. border could also be a factor. Since Trump took office, said the secretary, those prices have more than doubled from about $3,500 to about $8,000.
Supporters of right-to-work policy are pleased with the bill from U.S. Senator Rand Paul. Senator Paul, Republican of Kentucky, has introduced the National Right-to-Work Act to end forced union dues for workers. His bill is in partnership with a House bill introduced in February by Representative Joe Wilson and Representative Steve King, a Republican from Iowa.
We're excited that Senator Paul has introduced the National Right to Work Act, says Mark Mix, president of the National Right to Work Committee. The legislation, says Mix, repeals provisions in federal law that allow union officials to have workers fired for failing to pay dues or fees. It does not add a single word to federal law, he tells One News Now. It simply repeals those provisions from 1930s labor policies that gives union officials the ability to compel a worker to pay them for the privilege of working. Not surprisingly, unions are not happy. The legislation drives down wages, raises the poverty rate, and makes us less safe at work, the AFL-CIO stated in a tweet. This is not the first time that Senator Paul has introduced this bill, but it is the first time he's done it with a Republican-controlled Congress and White House.
Are Mix and the National Right to Work Committee optimistic that it will become law? Well, the political environment here in Washington, D.C. is really complicated, he answers. We believe that if we get a vote, we may have the votes in the House to pass it, but the Senate is a little bit different because the filibuster is still available to organize labor and their allies. Meanwhile, Mix says President Trump has indicated both on the campaign trail and through White House spokesman Sean Spicer that he would sign a bill should one get to his desk.
According to an authority on energy in the state of Texas, the battle for and against coal is far from over. Chuck DeVore, who serves as the vice president of national initiatives at Texas Public Policy Foundation, says that local utilities and state policymakers are going to be adjusting to a new reality in a nation with a new administration that is not actively trying to kill the coal industry.
This is going to play out over the next few weeks, months, and even years, DeVore told One News Now. You had 8 years of policy designed to kill coal. It isn't going to be reversed overnight, and you have utilities that have planned for the phasing out of coal. DeVore points to the Navajo Generating Station in Arizona as an example to make his case. The station is the largest coal-fired power plant in the western United States, but it is scheduled to be shut down in 2019. Environmentalists are pleased with the slated closure, citing health and climate concerns. However, National Public Radio points out that hundreds of Navajo people who rely on jobs in the Grand Canyon state are devastated. The issues over this matter have been deemed as extremely important in Washington, D.C. Even though President Donald Trump talked up the need for clean air and water in his recent address to Congress, he also spoke about the need for jobs and helping the economy, reiterating many of the points he talked about during his presidential campaign.
Since taking office, the president has also signed executive orders and legislation to, in his mind, aid the coal industry. One of the great things about coal-fired power plants, as well as nuclear and large hydro, is that they provide reliable and affordable baseload power, DeVore asserted. The challenge with wind power and solar power is that they're periodic, and if subsidized by the government, they can be cheap, but they aren't typically very reliable, so it's hard to base a modern electric grid on periodic power from renewable sources of energy. According to the Energy Information Administration, coal and natural gas were the number one sources of electricity generation in 2015, with both providing 33%. Renewables, meanwhile, provided only 7% of America's electricity, and more than half of that amount came from wind power.
Conservatives have called for the abolition of the United States Department of Education, or DOE, for many years, an idea that one expert on education believes is something that could happen in the near future. For some time, Neil McCluskey, who serves as the associate director with the Cato Institute Center of Education Freedom, has highlighted the fact that the existence of a Department of Education is not supported by the U.S. Constitution.
With the Trump administration now in power, McCluskey is confident that there are opportunities for discussing the future of the DOE. But it seems like now we could start to have an honest discussion about, with people on the left and the right, well, what are the dangers of the Department of Education and what good does it do, the director posed. And maybe we should seriously talk about downsizing it or eliminating it. He points out that Representative Thomas Massie, a Republican of Kentucky, has gone so far as to introduce a bill that simply states the Department of Education shall terminate on December 31st, 2018. I wouldn't put my money on the department disappearing in 2018, McCluskey conceded.
But I certainly think we can make some real progress in having a national discussion about that. And really important is the Massie bill certainly sends a great message that there are people in Congress who think the Department of Education shouldn't be there. The DOE was signed into law by former President Jimmy Carter on October 17, 1979.
A school in Oregon is now offering classes to teach millennials basic skills required to function as adults. A psychotherapist and a school teacher teamed up to form an adulting school in Portland, Oregon. The first classes were held last November. Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America suspects the breakdown of the family structure has put millennials at a disadvantage when it comes to learning adult skills they might have learned from their parents.
Most of these young people who are not functioning very well have not had parents, she tells One News Now. There's no father in the home, and the mother is trying to survive having to work and do the work of two people and be a parent and a homemaker at the same time. Subjects taught at adulting school include money management, time management, personal relationships, and even how to make a meal, according to OddityCentral.com. Krauss recalls when schools taught students skills they would need in adulthood, but she says that it is now lacking in education. I think of my grandchildren, for instance, she says.
They don't know how to sew. If there's something ripped on their clothes or a button off or something like that, they bring it to my house. And I think that's hilarious. But I had some home economics way back then. In fact, the psychotherapist states in the story that students are lacking some basic skills after schools dropped home economics courses.
As the battle over whether to keep or do away with Obamacare persists, the question looms as to where young Americans stand on the issue of health care. Spencer Brown of Young America's Foundation maintains that young people across the United States are simply looking for something that works for them.
I think the first thing that's important to recognize is Obamacare was just objectively a failure, Brown asserted. It was pushed through in a way that was very unpopular. It wasn't done the way legislation is typically done. Young people especially don't know what was in it, and nobody in Congress knew what was in it. From its very beginning, the youth leader says, the Affordable Care Act put what he called a bad taste in young people's mouths. Especially because they were just being told all of a sudden that everything is changing. You need insurance, and the only way to get it is probably through the government, Brown continued. I think one of the bigger criticisms of the Affordable Care Act was how much weight it put on young people and the cost for it. Right now, Brown contends that many young people are worried about tuition, paying off student loans, or getting a job. The thing on their list that they're not thinking about is how much they have to pay for health care, he pointed out. There are certainly various plans that seek to reform health care. Young America Foundation is a nonprofit 501c3 group and therefore cannot endorse any particular plan.
However, Brown is adamant that young people should definitely be consulted about their take on the healthcare debate. I think that's one thing that's usually overlooked are the young people in the country, especially in a situation like this, Brown expressed. Some people think young people aren't really engaged, that they're not going to notice what's going on. But young people do watch and see what's going on, he said. Another point many people fail to realize about America's younger generation is the fact that millennials are people who were born in the 1980s and 1990s. What works for a millennial teen or 20-something may not be the same thing that a millennial in his or her 30s wants or needs.
Kentucky made us legal, Charlie Brown. Kentucky legislators have passed a Charlie Brown bill to protect religious expression in public schools. The state Senate passed a religious freedom bill in a 31-3 vote last month, and the House passed it 81-8 on March 6th to send it to Governor Matt Bevin.
The legislation was crafted after school officials in a Johnson County public school censored a production of A Charlie Brown Christmas when Linus recites Christ's birth from the Book of Luke. Linus recites Luke after Charlie Brown, frustrated with the commercialism of the holiday, asks if anyone can explain the real meaning of Christmas. Peanuts creator Charles Schulz famously insisted on including the religious scene in the original A Charlie Brown Christmas, which first aired on CBS in 1965. School officials were worried the scene illegally promoted religion and removed it from the school production. Ironically, some critics said the bill was unnecessary, citing the First Amendment, but Alliance Defending Freedom attorney Matt Sharp says the school's action proved the need.
Even though the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that schools can include the Bible and other religious stories and elements as part of the educational process, there was confusion in Kentucky over this play, Sharp says. And so what this law does is reaffirm what the Constitution says. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after this.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The Fox News Network continued its dominating reign as the cable news behemoth by handily beating its left-leaning competition, CNN and MSNBC, in February ratings, so much so that more people watched Fox than the two liberal news sources combined. For the eighth month in a row, the Nielsen ratings show that more viewers watch Fox News than other basic cable networks, with the conservative news source beating out its competitors by an impressive margin. Last month, 1.75 million viewers tuned into Fox News, with Nickelodeon drawing 1.15 million viewers and HGTV pulling in 902,000 viewers.
When it came to attracting the viewership of the age group that news networks seek most, which is 25 to 54-year-olds, Fox News had little trouble trouncing its liberal rivals. The 21st century-owned cable news network was also up 39% in the key 25 to 54 demographic that advertisers covet most, with 592,000 total viewers, The Blaze reported. In total viewers and key demographics, Fox beat MSNBC and CNN in both categories combined, they said. Looking more specifically at the most viewed cable news shows, it was also found that Fox decimated the competition, boasting 13 of the top 15 programs offered in cable news overall. The only two news programs that broke into the top 15 with Fox are produced by MSNBC, the network that Megyn Kelly joined after leaving Fox News, where she was often seen battling now President Donald Trump during his presidential campaign. Coming in seventh was MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show, and The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell came in 13th. The only non-Fox programs on the list.
Even though Fox's numbers last month were impressive, they merely reflected a trend that has overtaken the cable news business for more than 15 years in a row, with February reflecting the overwhelming popularity that the conservative news network received as the nation's favorite cable source for presidential election coverage. February 2017 was the network's 182nd consecutive month as the most watched cable news channel in total viewers, The Blaze's Carlos Garcia announced. It was also the network's highest rated month since November 2016. Fox News does not appear to be regretting the loss of Kelly as its news anchor after replacing her with what many consider a more conservative choice.
Fox News has been shuffling personnel around, with Tucker Carlson taking over Megyn Kelly's spot after she left for MSNBC, Garcia noted. Ratings have increased dramatically with the new anchor, who has used his program to debate combatively many figures on the left, including Bill Nye, the science guy. The numbers reveal that Kelly is far from being missed, from a ratings standpoint at least, compared to Megyn Kelly's performance as host of The Kelly File in February of 2016. Carlson is up 31% in total viewers with 3.28 million and is up 55% in the key demographic with 695,000 viewers, Garcia added. Kelly was not the only one to leave Fox News for the more progressive and less popular MSNBC, as Greta Van Susteren also indicated she was hired by MSNBC after she parted ways with the conservative news network.
Many Americans, fed up with the left-leaning bias of the liberal news media, have switched to the more conservative, non-liberally charged Fox News. But members of its crew have also been noted as giving Trump a hard time as the nation's leading Republican figure. While many have seen Fox News as the pro-Trump news outlet, he had attacked them for what he saw as a bias in the past. And some Fox personalities have been very critical of the 45th president, including Shepard Smith and Chris Wallace, over Trump's attacks on the media, Garcia pointed out.
High school seniors may already have their college acceptance letters and financial aid offers in hand, but there's no reason to rush on making an enrollment decision. They're taking their time to assess those aid packages carefully. 6 in 10 colleges sent financial aid offers to students before the winter holidays, according to a new analysis of 145 colleges from Royal and Company. Last year, it took until early March to hit that benchmark. More students have already decided which college they'll attend to, with admissions up 5% compared to last year. Those students who were accepted and got a reasonable need-based award from an institution were content with that, said Pamela Keeker Royal, head of research at Royal and Company.
The surge in early bird offers are largely due to a recent change in the start date for filing the free application for federal student aid, also known as FAFSA, a form that determines eligibility for financial aid. Families are now eligible to file as early as October for the upcoming academic year, using income data from an earlier tax return. Under the old system, families had to wait until January 1st, 3 months later, and use data from the just-concluded tax year. Many families took advantage of the new start date to apply for financial aid early, giving them more time to assess the affordability, said Mark Kantrowitz, Vice President of Strategy for College and Scholarship Search Site, CapEx.com. Many colleges set their enrollment deadline as May 1st, which has come to be known as National College Decision Day. Due diligence ahead of Decision Day might include practical measures like making another visit to campus.
It should also include a thorough assessment of the aid offer, said Kevin Fudge, Director of Consumer Advocacy for American Student Assistance, a nonprofit focused on higher education financing. He advises students to analyze their financial aid packages closely. He says families should examine the offer line by line, separate out scholarships and grants which don't have to be repaid from loans that do, he said. That gives you a truer picture of your out-of-pocket costs. You may think you have a free ride from this college, when in reality you have a ridiculous amount of loans, he said. Be careful with outside scholarships. Make sure they don't offset grants from the college. It's okay if they offset loans. Also, make sure you include in your overall cost indirect expenses, like travel to and from campus and textbooks, as well as tuition, room and board.
Fill in the blanks for any missing expenses so you can better compare different colleges' offers. Look to see if the college estimates are reasonable, too, based on personal details like your student's major. A single physics or calculus textbook can cost you as much as $250 in today's world. And remember that it's a 4-year experience, not one. The aid package's addendum typically contains details like whether a scholarship can be renewed in future years and under what circumstances, he said. That's also where you'll find any conditions your student has to meet to keep the aid, like meeting a minimum GPA. And finally, a generous aid package as a freshman doesn't mean that your student will be awarded the same deal as an upperclassman. Depending on the terms, a college offering a smaller amount of annual aid, but as a 4-year award, might be the more valuable offer.
If your financial situation has changed since filing for financial aid, consider preparing an appeal to the college. They may be willing to adjust your aid package, Kantrowitz said, although that may simply mean more loans rather than additional grants. You might also reach out for a reassessment if one college offers more aid than another. But any bump up in aid resulting from that tactic is typically because the reviewing college realizes it was missing a piece of information about your finances that other colleges had, he said.
Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross told the Fox Business Network's Stuart Varney that the administration is taking a strong position against companies that violate trade agreements. We are going after violations of any aspect of our trade regimes, Ross said. ZTE, China's second largest maker of telecom equipment, has agreed to pay a record $1.2 billion fine for breaking U.S. sanctions. Ross noted other dishonored trade agreements and World Trade Organization rule violations would also be addressed by his department. We are going to be very harsh on enforcement, he said. Ross added that there are still billions in liabilities waiting to be collected. Historically, believe it or not, there are billions of dollars in countervailing duties that went uncollected for a whole variety of reasons, all of which we are trying to deal with.
And that wraps up this weekend's edition of News Out of the Box. On behalf of Kelly Sergenis, my co-host, and Curtis, our wonderful producer, I'm Joe Lerza, reminding you to always think out of the box.